IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. On the 12th of January, Madhya Pradesh Chief Minister Shivraj Singh Chauhan said something that was reported rather innocently in the media at the time. The main headline that the Indian Express, for example, came out with was that the Madhya Pradesh was going to raise the minimum age of marriage for women from the age of 18 to the age of 21 years. There was something a little more nefarious, if I can use that term, in the subtitle though. Basically, the Chief Minister proposed essentially a surveillance system by which, according to the article, any woman who was working away from her home would have to register herself with the local police station, who would apparently keep track of her activities for safety. Now, I'm sure that you can imagine, given the stellar track record that Indian policemen have, that this was inevitably going to have some rather dangerous consequences. And even beyond that, the very fact that such a measure was seen as being necessary, and the very fact that given that there are issues that Indian women face in public spaces, that this was the measure that was chosen to quote unquote solve the problem, I think is a really interesting opportunity for us to have a broader discussion about the way that Indian society treats and thinks about women and the challenges that they may face in India's public spaces. So I have with me today Asmita Ghosh. Asmita is a digital campaigner and a former campaign lead at Feminism in India. Thank you so much for joining us today, Asmita.
Hi, Anirudh. Thanks for having me.
Asmita, so let's begin by talking about the question of public spaces and just generally how Indian women engage in public spaces. Now, there's a tendency, I believe, that when people think about women in public spaces, it's very much about working women, you know, women who have to commute from one place to another. But there's an interesting difference that I've found in the way that men and women think about public spaces. In the first place, you're going to see men around on Indian roads, in parks, at very different times of day, right? You're going to see them there early morning, late at night. You will see men performing recreational activities, just hanging out and chilling in public spaces in a way that, and with the kind of freedom that Indian women don't necessarily do. So let's try to understand the differing experiences that people of different genders in India have in our public spaces. And hopefully we can kind of like use that as a starting point to have a discussion about this policy that Madhya Pradesh is proposing. So over to you. What do you think about the gendered ways in which Indians engage in public spaces?
So I think this example that you gave, Anirudh, was really interesting because I was going to bring that up myself. And it's actually a kind of the genesis of this book called Why Loiter, which is about how women experience and occupy public spaces. And it says that, you know, it's so common and natural to see men loitering in public spaces around tea stalls, smoking cigarettes, in parks and other spaces. But women always have to have a reason or a justification to occupy public spaces. Either you are going somewhere, you're going to school, you're going to college, you're going to work, you're coming back from work, that you need to have a valid, in quotes, reason for occupying public spaces, because public spaces are not made for women. They're not, we are not expected to be there, and we just get to borrow them for a little while to get to spaces that are appropriate for us to inhabit, like our workplace or our school or our college, but no more and no less. So you can't simply loiter and occupy public spaces, and that's pretty much the main argument of the book, Why Loiter, which I would definitely recommend everybody to read. And that, I think, it's very telling, right? Because women across India, and anyone who's not a man, actually, have all written and talked extensively about how deeply uncomfortable we are in our public spaces. Because when I, for instance, am on a road or in a public space, I know that first and foremost, I'm a woman. I'm a like a female body, in fact, right? For people to consume and wonder and speculate about my reasons for being out. And only then am I a human being. My body and my womanhood is always center stage when I'm at this space. And this sort of just reinforced by this public-private dichotomy that that society is built, where women's rightful space is in the privacy of our home, in the private domain, and men are supposed to be in the public space, women are supposed to be in the private space, and when women disturb that norm by being outside, we experience violence, we experience judgment, we experience questioning. All of which, contribute to making public spaces a deeply unsettling and uncomfortable space for us.
Hmm. That's an interesting point, Asmita. One thing that immediately struck me almost is the fact that this idea that a woman's place is in the home seems based on this kind of upper caste conception of the role of a woman,
absolutely,
right? So I would imagine that people from lower income or lower caste backgrounds don't necessarily have the option to keep the women at home. And therefore, in South India, at least, like one thing that really struck me when I on the few times I visited Delhi, and there are almost no women selling stuff on the streets. The guys who are like, folks who are selling food or vegetables are almost invariably men. And that doesn't necessarily seem to be a thing in Southern India, where, women will be out in marketplaces, they will be selling stuff, they will be entrepreneurs, they will be businesswomen. And as the Supreme Court has so ironically said recently, apparently without knowing that, women are also farmers,
yeah.
The Supreme Court was asking recently why women are quote unquote being kept in protests. So I kind of feel like it there's also this class and caste-based bias when it comes to conceptualizing what kind of women are allowed to be in public spaces and what kind of behaviors they should be adopting. But like you said, it's always meant to be very functional. It's always meant to be about, oh, you're here to earn your livelihood, is it? Okay, that's fine. You're here to study and get your degree, is it? That's fine. But don't do anything else. It's almost this hard-coded societal thing that, that's going to keep an eye on what women are doing and like ensure that they are not straying beyond that norm. And the second that they do, there's almost this washing of hands and saying, she wasn't following the norm. So, whatever happened is basically her fault, as it were.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you brought that up because it's very important. And of course, women's experiences of public spaces is not some monolith, and it is deeply influenced by our caste, class, religious positioning. And this kind of the discourse also that is around women in public space, the women, women's safety discourse or women in public spaces discourse is always geared towards a certain kind of woman, the middle class or the upper middle class. Indian woman. It is her that we must keep safe. It is her that we must protect. And I will talk about the safety discourse in a bit. But it's very true that we're not talking about working class women who anyway occupy public spaces. What about the female construction worker who is out late at night? Are we talking about her safety when we talk about
exactly.
Tracking her surveillance, tracking her movements within the police station? Is she going to come under the ambit of this policy, or do you just mean Hindu middle class women who need to be protected because then the honor of the community is in her vagina, this is a good segue into talking about this safety discourse that comes around when we're confronted with women occupying public space. Because this is what we've grown up with, right? When I am from Chennai, I moved to Delhi for work a few years ago, and my relatives were, beside themselves because Delhi obviously has a reputation for being highly unsafe. And it was all about like, how will you be safe? Like, don't go home late at night or, get home from work before 7 p.m. And I would, if I had to work late, I would lie to my parents, which is actually more unsafe because it would be safer for them to know that, I'm out late. But their anxieties about me being out late at night would often overshadow, my safety itself, right?
So maybe since we've already talked about the way that societal and parental expectations are so, they're so obsessed with the idea that you can, the only way to keep women safe is to keep them at home, that policies like this basically reflect that way of thinking rather than looking at the broader problem, which is why is it that women do not feel safe at home? And like, what are the real issues here that this societal obsession with keeping women safe is ending up ignoring?
Yeah, and policies like this actually reinforce that kind of belief exactly. that women ought to be at home, right? This whole, like you said, the obsession with women's safety is actually a very thinly veiled obsession with controlling women's mobility, controlling women's lives outside the home, right? If women dare to, you know, step outside the private sphere or step outside the control of their parents, then the state better have control of them, right? Or someone better have control of them. Someone better know what they're doing, because who knows what a woman can do if, you know, she's left to her own devices. So, this safety is really just about control and surveillance. And that's something we can clearly see in this policy. And again, like I said, the safety, we only care about a certain kind of woman's safety, right? We don't care about we're not talking about working class women, women from maybe marginalized communities. We're not talking about their bodies and their safety. You know, what protections do informal workers even have? You know, a lot of, like you said, when you brought up the women farmers, women who work in these kinds of professions, they're not even recognized. They're invisibilized. Nobody even knows that most of the farmers in India are actually women, right? So we don't account for these kinds of for all women when we're talking about safety, and then it becomes more about control. And one point here that I think is extremely relevant is why do we think that, you know, keeping women inside the house equals women's safety? Because statistics repeatedly show that like an overwhelming majority of sexual violence cases happens, the perpetrator is someone that's known to the woman. It's usually someone within the house or like a neighbor. It's not that shady, probably like the man from a marginalized caste, class, religious background who is out to get, you know, our Hindu middle-class women, in quotes. So that's a very convenient bogey man that we've created, right? Don't go out, don't go to parks late at night, or don't walk in the roads at night, because, you know, these strange men who are often in this imagination, poor, disempowered men, like, you know, construction workers or Uber drivers or whoever, they will be out to get you. And so to keep you safe, we're going to keep you inside the house. But what about the overwhelming rates of child sexual abuse that women, girls and boys face at the hands of relatives and parents, even at some point, in some cases, right? Who's protecting women from violence inside the house? So that really points out the hypocrisy of the safety thing. I mean, clearly nowhere, unfortunately, safe for women. The most, what you can do is try to address that, address the perpetrators and address the violence at its root, instead of trying to limit women's mobilities and freedoms with some excuse of trying to keep them safe, because clearly we've seen that we aren't safe anywhere.
It is so weird that like women are not considered Indian citizens to the point where it's okay to essentially use them and the struggles they face to do a little bit of chest thumping and say, oh yeah, no, we're protecting women, or we're doing this about women. And like, they're not seen, it seems almost that they're not seen as human beings and citizens with their own rights and their own agency in a lot of the discourse that underpins policies like this. So another interesting thing that you brought up, Asmita, was about...
Can I just add something to what you said right now?
Sure.
Yeah, so like you said, it almost becomes like a self-serving exercise of, you know, the male savior complex, essentially, as opposed to doing anything that actually benefits the lives of women, because none of these safety measures of which you know, keep women indoors or try to limit their lives really benefits women, but it makes men feel good about protecting women, and it's really very like a self-serving measure, honestly.
The most breathtaking example of this hypocrisy was this article I came across, where this right-wing group in Uttar Pradesh was interviewed, And they basically said that they have this network of like clerks and informants in various courts. So people who are applying for a secular marriage, basically their details had to be published, right, according to the law. So apparently this right-wing group has contacts to keep a track on women who are going to be doing a marriage like this. We'll track down her family, and apparently force the family to basically marry her off to one of their members, while having the sheer audacity to claim that they're protecting women's rights. So it just seems like this really cynical and hypocritical attempt to, I mean, there's no polite way to say it, to grab women's bodies while pretending that you're actually going out and saving them. So I just find it very distasteful. And given that Takshila stands absolutely for the liberty of India's citizens, I believe that would be our institution's stance as well. But let's come back to this current policy now, because really that the Love Jihad law is a can of worms that we should really go into at some other date. Let's talk about this thing that you brought up, Asmita, about how working class women, like, you know, for example, construction workers, we don't really talk about the policies that are going to apply to them and the kind of protections that they have. And if I recall correctly, some of the arms of the Indian state, especially the police, have a pretty egregious track record of, like, in terms of like how badly they treat these women. And even beyond that, you know, if we're talking about, let's say, middle class women who are moving to, let's say, a different town within Madhya Pradesh to work, the potential for misuse by police is just really gives me the creeps in the first place. Even though I think the mandated number of women in the police force is about 33% of the total, in practice it's closer to what, 5-6%. So that means that if a woman is going to a police station, she's inevitably going to have a bunch of really nosy policemen who want to know where she's going, what she's doing. We have no guarantee of like the kind of like legal procedures that these people are going to follow, whether these women are going to be subject to moral policing. If they have had to leave an abusive household, for example, and are trying to strike out and like become financially independent, is their family going to be informed of where these women are and what they're doing? And most importantly, like, even if, God forbid, something does happen and there is some crime that is committed against these women, how exactly does tracking their movements help bring justice to them? That's something I kind of fail to understand. You know, like, are you required to go and report to the police every time that you're going to be stepping out to loiter and not work, as it were? And if that happens, then given the kind of record that police and politicians in India have, is it just going to be a more efficient way to undertake victim blaming and say, hey, you know, she registered with the police saying that she was going to a bar, so what can be done? You know, the police tried to stop her, so but something happened, so it's really all her fault. What, and just wash their hands of the matter? It just seems like a sophisticated mechanism to pretend like something is...
Yeah, sophisticated victim blaming tools.
Exactly. I mean, that's what it seems like. It seems like a way to, like a very sophisticated way to shift the blame onto women for their safety while simultaneously abrogating to the state these very patriarchal ideas of like how to control and keep track of women. And I mean, at the risk of sounding dreadfully cynical, I'm sure that this can't be separated from the Love Jihad conversations that are happening in Madhya Pradesh and Uttar Pradesh in recent times. So what are your thoughts on the matter, Smita?
Well, I definitely, you know, echo everything you're saying. It's terrifying, honestly, the potential for a policy like this to ruin the lives of many women is immense. And I don't know in what delusional reality these people are living in, where they think that the police is actually a helpful institution for women, because we have seen, you know, starting from the Mathura rape case in the 1970s, where, you know, this young tribal woman was raped by two policemen when she went to the police to seek help, to, you know, like numerous cases, and like especially the way that, you know, sex workers are targeted by the police, for instance, or anyone, like even the examples that you've given, that the police have really been perpetrators of abuse in multiple instances for women. So how is giving the police basically an itemized list of everywhere that a woman can go supposed to keep women safe? I mean, that is terrifying. It's like handing stalkers, like I'm not implying that all police are stalkers or anything like that, but how would a woman feel comfortable with her every move being tracked? I mean, that is, by the way, already being done by members of her family as much as possible, or her marital home, because everyone, you know, there's so much anxiety when a woman is outside the home that everybody wants to keep track of her. And now we are giving this control to the police. It's ridiculous. And this is, I mean, this is like also a larger conversation about how institutions are not designed for women. Like our public institutions have repeatedly, we've seen, you know, to fail women. A case that comes to mind is this, a feeble no does not mean no judgment by the Supreme Court in the Mohammed Farooqi rape case, right? So the courts have shown us that they're not an ally to us. The police have shown us that they're not an ally to us. These institutions are not our savior, and these institutions are not where we're going to, you know, where feminism or women's equality or, you know, any progress for gender equality is going to be made. If it is, then we need to acknowledge, first of all, the harm that these institutions have caused women over decades, since their inceptions, maybe even, and how do we rectify that? But nobody wants to have that conversation, right? Nobody wants to look at state institutions like the army or the police, or the courts, the sexism rampant and the misogyny and the violence that these institutions perpetrate. That is never looked at. But then they want these institutions to be the saviors for Indian women all over the country. And that's just not going to happen. A woman is like one of the reasons that, you know, rape and GBV, gender-based violence, is so underreported is because of the fear that women have at like going to a police station or, you know, filing an FIR and pursuing it legally, because she knows that she's going to be re-victimized. She's going to be asked questions about, you know, why she was where she was when she got assaulted multiple times, and she's going to have to relive her trauma with very little chance of ever getting justice even, right?
Yeah.
So institutions have historically been unsafe for women. So this policy is like makes no sense to me. So another thing, the quote from the chief minister reads that any woman moving out of her house for her work will register herself at the police station, and she will be tracked for her safety. So this again brings me back to what I was saying in the beginning, that the work is pretty much the only legitimate reason a woman is allowed to be outside her house. There is no other reason that the state can envision that a woman might want to be outdoors. And if she is, then, you know, like you said, she deserves whatever assault or violence she faces. So like you said, it is a victim blaming. The victim blaming is sort of built into the policy itself. It just allows institutions like the police or the courts to blame women for their assault, and it gives them, you know, exactly the tools with which to do so by saying, you know, you were out past this time, or you were at this space where you were not supposed to be, like, what were you doing there? It basically hands a dossier of information that they can use to re-victimize and traumatize and blame the woman for any assault that she might face.
So one other ambiguity I found was just in the way that like work is framed in this policy, right? You say a woman who is going out of her house for work. So what does that mean? So if a woman is living independently by herself, does she still have to register? Or is it only if she's moving away from her marital or her family home to another place to work? I mean, the whole thing is just so badly worded and like just ripe for convenient misinterpretations by officials on the ground, that once again, it kind of seems like something that like I and my colleagues have talked about in other episodes of All Things Policy. So our listeners might have listened to the conversation we had about the way that vaccines were kind of pushed through without clinical trials. It almost seems that the emphasis is on the optics and on the politics of a policy rather than on the actual implementation and the effects that it's going to have. And rather than really looking can engage with its stakeholders and see the potential ways in which it can be used and misused over a particular period of time. It's all about making these big pronunciations that appear like they are solving the problem, but actually sidestep the problem entirely and instead end up granting the state the ability to kind of coerce more and more citizens. So it just seems to be continuing the general trend that we've been observing in policy making of late. All right, so we're almost at the end of our time, Asmita. So just a couple of things I'd like to quickly go over. The first was the environment itself that you talked about. So would you say that rather than basically giving the police more and more surveillance rights over women, a more effective way to combat the issues that women face in public spaces is to make police stations and institutions themselves more women-friendly? And if so, how would we go about doing that? What kind of reforms do you think would really work?
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with you that we need to, institutional reform is one of the ways in which we can actually improve women's safety. Even, you know, things like quick and effective complaint system, if you call the helpline, you will actually receive help when you're asking for it and not like the next day. And even, you know, things like lighting up roads and things like that, making it safer for women to be outside instead of saying women just shouldn't be outside and that will solve the problem.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. And like, I can imagine that there's just so many potential changes that need to be done. And because we're not just talking about institutions, but we're also talking about just generally the way that society looks and thinks about women in public spaces. I mean, you kind of touched upon this anxiety that families feel about, quote unquote, allowing their daughters to go out into public spaces. So one can imagine that like, combating that anxiety by actually enacting reforms on the ground that make societies feel safer and make women feel safer being outside would be a really big thing. But I mean, just imagining the scale of all that kind of boggles the mind. So it probably need to have time for a full conversation just about that at some later point. But the final thing that I want to bring out, Asmita, was something I kind of touched upon in this little ramble of mine here, which is just the way that this entire policy was presented. Like I said in the beginning of this podcast, it was very innocuously put in the subtitle of the Indian Express's initial article, like it wasn't really that big a deal. And it was basically uncritically repeating what the Prime Minister said. And looking at media coverage over the last few days, activists who have been pointing out the issues with this law and the consequences that it's going to have are almost being framed as if they're overreacting, while the government is being kind of framed as the voice of reason, at least in the media. So rather than initially frame these statements and these policies by talking about the consequences, the media instead seems to be shifting the discourse in a way that makes the government seem like it's in the right and like it's well-intentioned here, rather than actually holding it to account like it is supposed to in a democracy. So are there better ways that this could have been framed? Ideally, how would the media engage with policies like this that take away the autonomy of women?
Yeah, absolutely. This is actually a big issue with the way that the media reports many issues regarding women, especially gender-based violence, women's safety, but also other policies that affect women, where if there is like a problematic statement said by maybe a judge, a police officer, or the state, the courts, whatever, that forms the headline and there's nothing else. And I understand that maybe, you know, if it's a controversial statement, putting that as a headline might get you more clicks and things like that. But then you should, I mean, the media has a responsibility to either counter it if it's obviously harmful, as in this case of this Madhya Pradesh policy. And if they don't, you know, because they can't editorialize and they can't take a stance, then as you said, you know, bring in balancing counter opinions in a way that obviously not in the way that you mentioned it's happening as an overreaction, but as a counter measure, or as what you know, activists and people who actually work for women's rights, you know, outside of it just being a shiny propaganda tool, what they have to say. And so I've actually written about this in, I'm just going to plug this a little bit, I know a toolkit that I've created called the GBV in Media Toolkit while I was working at Feminism in India. And where we basically looked at the way that the media reinforces a lot of very problematic assumptions about women in the way that it reports gender-based violence or rape and other kinds. Yeah, so basically just being a little bit more responsible. Maybe, for instance, in this case, the media could have definitely, you know, connected it to love jihad, how this could be a tool to target women, target interfaith couples, how it detracts from women's autonomy and freedoms. These are things that either they could have said, or if they don't feel comfortable, you know, saying it themselves, they could have cited activists and academics or scholars who are saying these things. Because it's very irresponsible to just uncritically paraphrase a problematic or misogynist statement and not counter it at all, because then that you're just adding to, you're just reinforcing, or you're endorsing almost the statement by not providing a counter opinion responsibly.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Asmita. So we're actually going to put a link to this dossier in the description, so anybody who's interested can check it out. I know that this is a little bit more of a harrowing conversation than we generally have on All Things Policy, but every now and then it's kind of important to take a stand on issues that affect all of us. And I hope I certainly learned a whole lot from this conversation. I have a much more kind of nuanced understanding of the way that policies like this are framed and the way that they impact the lives of Indian citizens. And I hope that all of you learned something from this conversation as well. We will put Asmita's Twitter handle into the description, so please follow her. And let's hope that this policy proposal remains just that, a policy proposal, and that the government considers more deeply the way that its statements and its proposed policies are going to actually unfold and impact the lives of Indian citizens. On that note, thank you so much, Asmita, for joining us.
Thank you so much, Anirudh. This was a great conversation. I really appreciated your insights as well.
It was a pleasure. And thank you all for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.